So we're active worldwide. Our major, the two major similar institutions are the New York Botanical Garden and the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew near London. We're all engaged in plant inventory around the world. We differ. Some of our distinctive characteristics are that we have people actually stationed all over the world, finding out about the kinds of plants and applying that knowledge to conservation and sustainability in many different countries.
I've traveled the globe a bit, and it seems to me that while there is a great deal of diversity in plant life, there is a great deal of sameness in plant life. For instance, if you travel to Ukraine, you find trees that look similar, the weed species are the same, and the crops are very much the same. How much diversity is there on our planet from one end to the other, north to south?
You know, the diversity is greater as you move from north to south and as you move from east to west. And as Jared Diamond points out in his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, where he's talking about the dispersal of crops around the northern hemisphere, one of the reasons that agriculture spread across Eurasia so easily is it spread at the same latitude. In the north temperate region, there are about 18,000 species of plants in the U.S. and Canada. About 40% of them are found only here, but many of the genera, like oaks and birches and willows and so forth, are all around the northern hemisphere, but probably with different species. Compared to the roughly 18,000 kinds in the U.S. and Canada, there are about 11,500 in Europe and about 31,500 in China, which basically has both retained more archaic kinds of plants and animals than the other two areas for historical geological reasons, and also had a great deal of the development of new species on the many mountain ranges in China. Not very many people realize that 40% of China is above 6,000 feet elevation. So there are many, many mountain ranges there, and each one tends to have its distinctive biological diversity.
So that's the geological side of why there are so many different species
there.
Well,
why it's common around the northern hemisphere. Then if you go south, to get directly onto your question, about two-thirds of all the species of plants and animals live in the tropics, and in general those would be different from those found either north or south. And, of course, in the southern hemisphere, the temperate regions are separated from one another by very wide stretches of ocean, so that the plants and animals in South Africa, southern South America, and Australia and New Zealand all differ quite a bit from one another. They're all somewhat isolated from one another. But as I say, about two-thirds of the diversity, and by far the least well-known parts of the diversity, are in the tropics.
Are you concerned at all the diversity of plant life around the globe is narrowing?
Oh, it's definitely narrowing as a result of habitat destruction. Well over half of all the tropical forests in Southeast Asia are gone now, and people are hammering away at it in Africa and in South America. And it seems likely to me and to many of my colleagues that half probably of all the biological diversity on Earth is in danger of extinction during this century. Another factor that's, of course, emerged as being of great importance is global warming, because a lot of the habitats where plants and animals grow now, and an obvious example would be mountains near the southern ends of those lands that I listed in the southern hemisphere, a lot of those habitats are simply disappearing. In the United States, there will be no real area above timberline by the end of this century by any climate change model, no alpine habitats, no Arctic tundra, and of course the plants and animals that live there either will have to accommodate themselves to relatively open places like rocky slopes that are below timberline now, or they'll simply disappear from the lower 48 states. So there's a huge amount of extinction going on, and as that extinction goes on, the world is becoming less and less rich biologically and less diverse. And, of course, with that lowered amount of genetic diversity is a lowered potential for replenishing natural communities or for finding the kinds of genetic diversity that can be used to increase agricultural productivity or other desired characteristics.
Well, I suppose, and this is a question that's kind of strange, I guess, but that would be replenishing quickly, but replenishing over time shouldn't be terribly hard to do.
No, but we're probably talking about tens of millions
right.
of years, and since the average life of a species of mammal, which is what we are, is about 2 million years, and we're at about 2 million years now, waiting around for 20 million years may well not be an option.
Well, it doesn't sound like it's an awfully good option.
Well, at least it's an awfully philosophical point of view.
Yeah.
We probably would want to take more practical action.
Well, what kind of practical action should be taken? And maybe let's deal, for instance, with destruction of lands or clearing of lands for agricultural uses. What kinds of things are practical applications? I have one from the governor of Mato Grosso, Maggi. He has an idea. Maybe you've got some, too. Governor Maggi, in an interview that I had done with him well, a year and a half ago, suggested that the world should pay he and his fellow farmers not to destroy parts of the forest lands in Mato Grosso or the rainforest, and that because they own those lands, the world, if they wanted to salvage them, had the right or the ability to go ahead and keep them from destroying them.
Carbon sequestration, of course, keeping carbon dioxide from entering the atmosphere, which thus avoids global warming, is one reason that people are beginning to pay for those rights. In the tropics, there's a market in carbon, in locked up carbon, that is used as a balance for emitting carbon, both in Chicago and in London. And people are coping now with how to value tropical forests and other forest resources for those purposes. It is logical, it's perfectly logical to do what the governor of Mato Grosso said, which is to pay for saving biological diversity as well, but we haven't quite gotten to that point. The world is, of course, notoriously composed of haves and have-nots, and in countries like the United States, we haven't gotten used to the idea of handing out money to people in developing countries to improve their lot. We tend to keep it here. It's the United States has 4.5% of the world's people and 25% of the world's economy, which shows itself as first approximation that we depend on sustainability in countries all over the world to flourish. And if we don't pay more attention to that, we'll be suffering the consequences. Obviously, your end of the boat is sinking is not a workable formula now, if it ever was. So it's a perfectly logical suggestion, but when we find it difficult to deal with poor or disadvantaged people, even in our own communities, it's going to take a lot of changed attitude to begin to deal effectively with poor or disadvantaged people or the preservation of biological diversity around the world. I hope we'll get to that point, but I don't know when.
Would it be advisable to allow landowners here in the United States to set aside those lands and try to sequester carbon on farmlands?
Oh, I think so. And one of the things that a lot of people are wondering about now is which agricultural systems sequester the most carbon.
Right.
Of course, our reserve lands are getting planted up now pretty ferociously in the struggle to generate biofuels. But provided that we've worked through those things, I absolutely do think that it's very logical to pay farmers for locking up carbon also.
This is the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of WILL Public Radio from the University of Illinois. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Raven. He's a botanist at Washington University and president of the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like for Illinois and Indiana, says Chief Meteorologist Ed Keezer. Tonight's skies should be mostly clear. Lows will generally range between 50 and 55. A bit warmer near Lake Michigan and in some of the city centers. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs will range from 80 in northern and eastern Indiana to 87 in the southwestern part of Illinois. The extended forecast says dry weather will be expected in most areas on Saturday. A few showers might back into the eastern parts of Indiana from the east on Saturday. A cold front expected to pass through the two-state area Monday afternoon and evening. And that should trigger a few scattered showers on Monday afternoon through Tuesday. Then mostly dry weather will return on Wednesday, although a few pop-up afternoon showers could be expected in parts of Indiana. Temperatures will turn significantly cooler for a few days with below average readings expected Tuesday night through Thursday night of next week. Highs on Wednesday, the coldest day, will only be in the upper 50s and 60s, and lows on Thursday, the coldest morning, will be in the mid-30s to the mid-40s. Some of the normally coldest spots may see a touch of frost, but a widespread frost or freeze is not expected.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation on the U of I campus. McKinley is active in addressing issues of social justice and offers education for all ages. Committed to inclusiveness, McKinley welcomes all. On the web at www.mckinley-church.org.
You're listening to the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. Our guest is Dr. Peter Raven of the Missouri Botanical Garden. When we left, we were talking about carbon sequestration. Dr. Raven, does it really work?
Yes. How much it works? I mean, there's far more carbon in the soil worldwide than there is in plants. And how well we can capture that and what we need to do to protect it, one of the obvious things being no-till, is something that people need to work through very thoroughly and in a variety of different circumstances. But yes, it certainly works. You know, how much and what the value is are things that we've yet got to agree on. I need to say that increasing agricultural productivity on the lands that are already being cultivated is one of the best strategies for being able to protect biological diversity in lands that are not cultivated. And conversely, low production agriculture is a very bad strategy for protecting anything, as is, for example, widespread grazing animals on natural pastures, because most of that is unsustainable.
This causes me to ask the next question. How much involvement does the botanical garden or support does it get from Monsanto?
We get support, but we're not doing any particular. We're not doing any joint research, and we're not doing research that has any direct relationship to one another. Now, we and Monsanto and Washington University founded the Donald Danforth Plant Research Center, which University of Illinois is a partner in, but it's an independent organization with an independent board that is trying to do, that is doing basic research in plant biology intended to improve agricultural productivity. But as I say, it's its own institution. And as I also said, we get support from Monsanto, but so do all the cultural institutions in St. Louis, and we have no common research programs. Washington University and the Danforth Center do have research programs that are supported by Monsanto, but at a pretty arm's-length way.
Let's talk a bit about the Danforth Center, if we could, for a time being. Mm-hmm. This was a center that was established in the late 90s and I think opened in 2002 or thereabouts.
Was established in 1999 because 1998 because
right.
It's celebrating its 10th anniversary now, and the building opened, yes, probably in 2002.
Right, and this was termed, I think to be the mecca of genetic genetic modification areas and
plant. No. Well, go ahead.
Plant exploration, I suppose, might be a better term. Has it been succeeding?
It was intended to be and has been a place where one works on basic plant molecular and cellular biology in order to make possible advances in agricultural productivity, but also to learn about the basic biology in focused ways, for example, root biology, drought resistance to some extent, and similar properties of plants, how those are facilitated or how those come about at a molecular and cellular level. And yes, a number of research groups have been formed there within the Danforth Center, which have been very successful in making scientific advances in some of those fields. And after 10 years of operation, the center is coming to a kind of maturity and, of course, cooperates a lot with the four university partners that it has.
Those are the University of Illinois, Missouri,
Purdue, the University of Missouri, Purdue. Columbia. I guess there are only three.
Yeah, I was thinking that Iowa State might be involved, but
well,
I don't,
we wanted
recall.
Them to be. We wanted them to be, but that never worked out. It's perfectly open, but we've been busy consolidating our relationships with Illinois, Purdue, and Mizzou in between, and so not trying hard to add Iowa State, but obviously Iowa State is the logical additional partner. Those are the four strongest agricultural institutions in the Middle Midwest.
Well, our time is flying by quickly. Anything we haven't covered, we've got maybe a couple of minutes left, that you want to make sure that we talk about today?
Just to emphasize again that the garden's work is very much to develop the capability of countries around the world to understand the properties of their own plants. And we have a great deal of training and a great many resident scientists out there doing it. And by doing that, we are emissaries of St. Louis and the Midwest and the United States, and we're helping to attain sustainability in various ways. We look for ways to intelligently preserve natural habitats and natural communities. We look for ways for rural people in the countries where we're active to be able to sustain themselves better through growing food for themselves, for example, much as you might do in inner city